I'd like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:02 p.m. on Thursday, March 2nd, 2023. We're meeting in the Davis Room 106 of the Capitol. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others. Otherwise, you're going to owe us donuts. And with us in attendance today, we have Representative Sumner, Representative Sadler, Representative Ruffridge, and Representative Mina. We have a quorum. Oh, and myself, Representative Prox. We have a quorum to do business. Welcome back, everyone. I'd also like to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye, over in the corner. If you have notes or if you need help, he'll take care of that. Our returning records recorder, Suniva St. Clair, and Amanda Kraft, our teleconference moderator. Thank you for helping us. We have four bills on the agenda today. First hearing of HB 52, No Patient Left Alone Act by Representative Vance. House Bill 6, Opioid Awareness in the Public School Program from Representative Rauscher. HB 56, Controlled Substance Database, which is we want to exempt. The bill wants to exempt veterinarians from the Controlled Substance Database by Representative Ruffridge. And the second hearing for HB 17, Contraceptive Coverage for Insurance and Medicaid by Representative Carrick. So we want to keep things moving along. That's why I bothered to say that. So first up, we have House Bill 52, No Patient Left Alone Act. And I'd like to invite Representative Vance and her chief of staff, I think, Jake Almeida, to come forward to the table, introduce yourselves for the record, and walk us through the presentation, and watch your knees. And do we have invited testimony today, Representative Vance? We do.
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chairman. We have one in person and one online.
Okay, very good. All right, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Health and Social Services Committee for hearing House Bill 52. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6 of the Lower Kenai Peninsula. These past several years have taught us on how to respond to emergencies, natural disasters, and unforeseen global pandemics. Hopefully, we've all learned how to properly wash our hands and that it's certainly not too polite to sneeze on our neighbors. Nevertheless, the most important lesson we've learned throughout all of this is to say, I love you, and to squeeze our loved ones and give them a hug one more time before we leave for the day. We've learned that connection with people matter most. House Bill 62 seeks to safeguard a patient's rights to a support person receiving emergency medical services or staying at the hospital, nursing facility, assisted living home, or hospice care. This bill ensures no patient is left alone when they feel most medically vulnerable and may not be withheld a support person based on a state or federal declaration of disaster. It allows for civil penalties and requires healthcare facilities to make visitation policies available to the public. The pandemic has caused great uncertainty and anxiety across Alaska and has significantly affected the medical community. Many unintended consequences have happened to patients because of visitation policies that have prohibited them from having any visitors, including a spouse, parent, close family member, guardian, healthcare agent, chaplain, or caregiver. And as a result, many have been forced to be alone during their treatment for serious conditions, traumas, illnesses, heart attacks, and routine emergency surgeries. Some of these patients have been forced to be alone for the entire course of their treatment, and in some cases, have died alone. And many families have been unable to be physically present with their loved ones while in a hospital, nursing home, hospice care, adult care home, special care unit, or residential treatment setting for mental illness, development or intellectual disability, or substance use disorder. Alaskans have been limited to electronic video communications, if any, with the patient, And the patients who have been affected have included adults, minors, and individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities. However, it is my belief that it is our moral obligation that these patients be allowed at least one support person to be physically present at reasonable times throughout the period of hospitalization or residential treatment. Let me take you back to September of 2020, when we read in the news about a father from Kodiak who camped on the lawn at a prominent hospital in Anchorage. His daughter had a severe asthma attack and was medevaced to Anchorage. The desperate father offered to take tests and wear protective gear just to be present with his daughter, believing that her health would improve if she knew he was by her side. The hospital refused. With the permission of a patient in my district, I share his experience. A little over a week ago, I found myself leaving a local doctor's office and entering into the doors of the ER at SPH with COVID. I was admitted to the hospital, underwent the standard battery of tests, stabilized, treated, and thankfully released to finish my recovery at home. It was this experience that has made me change my opinion regarding the allowance of a loved one to be present during the hospitalization and treatment of a patient. Prior to my recent experience, I was moderately sympathetic to those whose loved ones were admitted into the hospital and were forced to remain apart from them during their stay. At the time, it seemed reasonable that the comings and goings of extra people in the rooms be restricted to stop unnecessary exposures. I suppose it must be karma that I found myself in that very predicament. I have never felt as helpless and afraid as I did as I was laying in the hospital bed, struggling to breathe, all alone. Knowing the last moment I had with my wife was a squeeze of her hand and watching the tears roll down her face as they took me back to the ER. The next 24 hours was a very real struggle, both physically and emotionally. I think there are considerations beyond the calculations known that must be weighed when rendering aid and care to human beings. In our modern calculations, comfort of proximity and touch of a loved one isn't considered in the equation. Now, reflecting on my recent experience, I can see that I was at least partially incorrect in failing to keep that in mind. Looking at the moment, I can see that more than the patient is being treated, that a loved one can act as much as a positive drug in the positive outcome of treatment schedule as the pill or shot. That my life, had it a different outcome and had ended there, would have been tragically unfinished. As humans, we all have moments. Some are big, some are small, but they are cumulative and make us complete. It is how we treat those moments at the end of our lives that allow us to really be human, to give us the final moments of closure, to leave behind our loved ones with a sense of completeness, even if filled with sadness. It was a difficult realization to come to as I struggled to breathe in that bed, listening to the alarms going off in the dark, wishing only that the one hand in the world that mattered was in mine. I thank my constituent for allowing me to share his story and his experience of the realization that caused him to change his mind about what is appropriate care. It is my pleasure to say that he did live, and he is enjoying life with his wife. But it is a good reminder of how we must treat those who are in care, whether it's in a hospital, a nursing home facility, that we must provide human dignity. So I'd like to transition to going through the slide and talking about the merits of the bill itself. So obviously, as we look at legislation, we ask, what does this bill do? The main components of the bill is to provide rights of patients to support. It allows for civil liability. It says that the rights cannot be suspended. It requires healthcare facilities to provide written policies. And it allows the Department of Health to investigate when there are complaints. So let's discuss the patient's right to a support person. The bill clearly states that a healthcare facility shall allow a patient to have a support person of the patient's choice in person at all times during the patient's stay. This is, I specified in person so that there could be no loophole, because some hospitals have said, made iPads available, which was helpful at the time. However, it does not replace the contact of an in-person loved one being by a patient's side. A support person's visitation privileges may not be limited to the visitation hours of the provider or healthcare facility. And a patient's right to a support person under this section may not be withheld based on a state or federal declaration of disaster. This says that while the pandemic was going on, we still especially cannot neglect the human dignity of having a support person by their side during their times of feeling most medically vulnerable. The next provision allows a civil liability. A patient, support person, parent, guardian, or person standing in the place of a parent may bring a civil cause of action against a healthcare professional or healthcare facility that violates this act. If a plaintiff prevails in action brought under this section, the court shall enjoin the defendant from violating the statute or aiding and abetting a violation of the statute and award. This is simply saying that if they are not satisfied with the health department, that they can bring a civil liability, a civil cause of action. This puts it directly into the hands of the individual. Rights cannot be suspended. This is a complaint that I heard more than ever, is that the rights of the individual for human dignity shouldn't change based upon a natural disaster or something like the pandemic. A patient's right to a support person under this section may not be withheld based on state or federal declaration of disaster. The rights may not be terminated, suspended, or waived by the Department of Health or any other state agency. A healthcare facility shall inform each patient of the patient's right to have a support person in person, including any restriction on that right, and shall ensure that a support person enjoys full and equal visitation privileges consistent with policies and procedures. This allows the hospital, the healthcare facilities, the opportunity to make clear what their provisions are and treat everyone equally. There have been complaints that there's a lack of communication about what the policies are, how to get a hold of that information, and that they're not being treated equally, that maybe if there is a relationship with someone in a healthcare facility, that those people who have relationship get more preference. We want to ensure Alaskans have equal rights when it comes to being there to support their loved ones. And as stated before, this clarifies that healthcare facilities must provide written policies. A healthcare facility shall make a current version of its visitation policies and procedures available to the public. If they have an internet website to update their written policies there, they can provide it in written form, have it displayed in a conspicuous place, and that their procedures may be requested at any time. This is to open up the communication with the public about what the written about what the policies are around having a support person in visitation, because not everyone feels that it is adequately available. It also includes investigations by the health department. An individual may file a complaint with a commissioner if a healthcare professional or healthcare facility violates this statute. The commissioner shall investigate the complaint, and if the commissioner finds a violation, may impose a penalty. But I do want to make one last thing very clear. Unless required by federal law or regulation, a state agency may not take action against a healthcare facility for prohibiting a visitor from entering an operating room, isolation unit, behavioral health setting, or other typically restricted area. The state agency can't take action if the healthcare facility refrains people from administration of emergency care in critical situations, or from limiting them access beyond the room, unit, or ward in which the patient, the support person is visiting, is receiving care, or beyond general common areas. We know that there's going to be that one guy that wants to go back in the operating room. Well, I'm sorry. Just because you have a right to be there for your loved one doesn't mean that you get to be present during the times where the medical community needs to perform their duties like emergency care or operations or back in other known restricted areas. This allows the healthcare facilities to be able to retain those rights of limiting access to the public. I would now like to defer to invited testimony and leave it up to the chair if we have any further questions, but we do have two testifiers who have remarks prepared.
Okay, I'm thinking it would be best to hear the invited testimony first. Might address some questions, so let's proceed with that. And in person, we have Janet Ogan. Janet, if you would please come forward to the witness table.
Good afternoon, Chairman Prox and the members of the Health and Social Service Committee. For the record, I'm Janet Ogan. I'm representing myself and my family. I reside in Palmer, Alaska. And I would like to tell you how we need HB 52. Last July, my sister-in-law was admitted to Mat-Su Regional Hospital with pneumonia. The hospital tested her for COVID and it came back positive. From that moment on, the nightmare began for our family. Melissa was terrified and did not want to be there, let alone be put on a ventilator. They would not let my family members in. My brother, who is the husband of Melissa, was denied any physical contact with his wife for 9 days until her death. Excuse me. Her children never saw her alive again. They informed him that he was not welcome there. No amount of fervent persuasion could change their mind. He tried many times, and eventually they said, "Do not come back." During a time of sickness and being admitted to a hospital is a very vulnerable time for many. Being scared is natural. This is when our loved ones need a familiar face, or a loved one, or a friend. Excuse me. To add a measure of comfort in being an advocate for them. My brother was only allowed FaceTime through the computer, but regrettably, it didn't work. Even if it did work, it's no replacement for the healing or physical touch and the love and compassion of being surrounded by your loved ones. All he wanted was to physically connect with his wife. Frustrated is an understatement to describe how he felt. The hospital informed him that if things took a turn for the worse, they would call him. 9 days later, that call came in. My brother and his family risked their lives driving 80 miles per hour to be by her side before she passed. It took them 40 minutes. Tragically, she died before they arrived. Now that she was deceased, my brother and family members were suddenly allowed in the room. Who are they trying to protect? She already had COVID. What logic justified this deprivation of human dignity? What you need to understand about my family is that we're a very large family. I have 10 siblings. When we lose a family member, we have traditions, even a ritual of surrounding that member with nonstop care, contact, and love. We cook, we eat, we cry, we laugh, we hug, we tell stories. We know how to let our family members die with love, care, and dignity. We console each other, and it's very healthy and a loving way to grieve. We know how to honor, love, and support our departed family members to each other. We were robbed of not being able to comfort Melissa, our Melissa, and each other during her last moments on this earth. We had no opportunity to express our love or say goodbyes. We had no opportunity to support each other and grieve in a healthy way. That Sioux Valley Regional Hospital stole Melissa's right to die with dignity and robbed my family's cherished traditions. Their callous disregard resembled what would only one could call cruel and inhumane. And may I add that my cat died with more dignity than my sister-in-law. We were there with my kitty all the time before he passed, but that was not allowed for my sister-in-law. The trauma is real. My brother wept inconsolably for hours holding his deceased wife. Have they no shame? My heart broken is still grieving for the loss of a loved one and for the ongoing suffering of my brother and our whole family, who were cruelly and arbitrarily deprived of a healthy, loving Burke family. Goodbye. My brother could accept her death if he had been able to comfort her during her illness and die in his arms, but it was denied. The lack of empathy from Matsu Regional was palpable and inhumane. Our family is still very raw from this experience. My brother is guilt-ridden about taking her to the hospital. He lost his one and only true love, and we lost a treasured loved one. While the impact of the actions of the hospital's protocols have been devastating to her family, I know many others have suffered similar actions taken by other healthcare institutions. My heart grieves for their losses too. May the Lord comfort them during this season. A society can be judged by how it treats its elderly, unborn, and sick. COVID ushered in a dark era in the USA that I could only compare to cruel and inhumane treatment during the darkest times of human history. When did it become the norm to deny a patient any rights or have their loved ones make decisions in their care? When did it become acceptable to force one accepted treatment protocol and not allow the right to try other treatments? When did it become acceptable to deny a human being a compassionate and dignified death? What have we become as a country that used to value liberty and freedom to make medical decisions for ourselves and our loved ones? HB 52 is a step in the right direction. I sincerely hope all of us can return to our true identities of who we once were, a kind, compassionate, and the ability to express our opinions without being demonized. I fervently pray that this bill will become law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and our condolences to you and your family. And we have, is it Matthew Thomas online? Do we have, I got the wrong name. Oh, good. Okay, Dr. Natalie Baylor, are you online?
Yes, it's unmuted.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony, please.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Natalie Baylor, D.O., Board Certified Internal Medicine. I live in Palmer, Alaska, and have so since 1989. And I've been an Alaska resident since 1987 and practiced medicine in Alaska since 1987. I'm the owner of Dr. Natalie Baylor and Associates, and I've been practicing here for all those years. Operated my own clinic. I was the director of our critical care and intensive care for over 16 years and the director of our pulmonary care department for over 25 years at Matsu Regional Hospital. It wasn't until the hospitalists and hospitals started employing their own physicians that privately employed physicians such as myself have been relegated to backseat drivers, unfortunately. And I think that's probably why my testimony and support for HB 52 is so important, and it's a shame that more physicians like me will not have the opportunity to testify before this committee. To me, this whole situation seems absolutely an insane exercise in recognizing the absolute 100 million percent importance of the presence of family members and or designated next of kin for these people who so need end-of-life support, and not even just end-of-life support. I tried to do a little bit of research. I only had about 24 hours to think and prepare for this, but as I was doing my research and trying to come up with statistics that documented and gave support to the presence of caregivers in the support and well-being of patients, not only in the end of times, but in any kind of medical procedure. We all know from the football injury on the field when a player wakes up and sees the eyes of his coach and parents or the familiar faces of those he loves, the healing process begins immediately. It's when you're surrounded by strangers and non-caring individuals who are just acting almost like robots, as they've been so trained to do in the last couple of years, that the outcomes seem to shift. But in my last few hours of research, there's not one iota of evidence that would support anything but the presence of loved ones and family care providers for the sick and injured or dying or even recuperating. You know, when I was a resident, we were doing studies on hospital rooms and the importance of a hospital window for patients and recuperation, down to the fact that they even separated on how well a patient recovers if you were in a double room or a ward. And those patients that were placed by a window and were able to see a tree had the ability to recuperate from their illnesses up to 80% and better over those patients who were deprived ability to see outside. You don't even need a study to prove that the presence of a loved one would improve outcomes for patients who are going through some of the darkest and worst times of their lives. They're confused, they're over-medicated, sedated, they have ICU psychosis many times. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of the lack of clarity that a patient is going through with the simplest of procedures, whether it's a tooth extraction or brain surgery. It doesn't matter. But seeing a familiar face, that squeeze on the hand that Mrs. Ogun was talking about, there's absolutely no substitute for that kind of human and humane interaction that would improve medical outcomes for the patient. And we haven't even begun to talk about the long-lasting impact on those that are left behind. Once patients move on to the next level in their journey, wherever they are going, they're, please God, let it be a peaceful place of understanding. But those that are left behind are left with, if they are not able to provide the love and the support and care and giving that they've been trained to do, or just know innately to do, they're left with regret, remorse, grief that lasts much longer than the normal grieving period, anxiety, depression. Our emergency rooms now are filled with families who were unable to say goodbye to a loved one. They're filled with guilt that they didn't somehow find a way around the system. They're filled with guilt at even taking their family members to a hospital. If that isn't a terrible, terrible testimony on the place that we find ourselves in providing health care right now to our patients, as I'm ashamed to even say sometimes that I'm a doctor. I literally hang my head in shame because I can't tell you one patient whose life hasn't been affected over the past couple of years that they haven't been able to provide their family member with just the love, the care, the concern that they, you know, even reading a medication label. I mean, I just recently went through surgery myself, and if it weren't for the love and support I have around me, I wouldn't have been able to even take the bottle, the cap off of a bottle of a pill. And we've known probably for centuries now that the presence of a loved one at a bedside, especially of a critical ill patient, and in hospitals that overrun right now, and the nurse-to-patient ratio is absolutely incredibly high, so we have to rely on the presence of a loved one at the bedside. You know, there's something called cryptic shock. And cryptic shock is something that only usually those who are in the person's body or someone who loves them very closely will know. Like something's different here. Yeah, the blood pressure's okay. Maybe the pulse is up a little bit. The temperature's okay. There's really no outward sign that a nurse or another provider who already has their hands full taking care of up to 6 or 7 other patients may not be privy to, but a loved one at the bedside could say, you know, excuse me, that something's not right. Something's not. Those are the patients that survive. The ones, unfortunately, who pass, the ones who are readmitted to the hospital, the ones who die at home alone, are the ones who don't have someone rallying around, speak their voice, their heart, their soul, they just know, you know, just like Mr. Zogan said, you just have, in addition to family traditions, you just have the signs and symptoms of knowing when something's not right with your loved one. And, you know, just a couple of personal stories about recently the impact of patient survivability. I mean, if we had all day and all night, I could fill textbook on textbook of cases where patients have had improved outcomes or survival, preventive death, et cetera, by a loved one. But one of the most recent was a family with a husband and wife. They're both patients of mine. He contracted a very, very serious illness and was taken to the hospital by his wife. She didn't want him to go. She was afraid that he would be admitted to an ICU and possibly intubated. And she had educated herself enough to know that the outcomes of this particular illness are worse when intubated. But they, just like in the Ogun situation, weren't allowed to even be in the emergency, let alone. But she's a very forceful person and ended up banging on the intensive care unit doors that she wasn't allowed in, but she could hear the talk when the doors would open and close, and they were talking about intubating her husband, whose oxygen was low, and he was confused and in delirium because of his medical condition. But the one person that he relied on to be his spokesperson was his wife. When she heard what they were going to do, she managed to barge past the security guard, managed to make her way in front of his room, where she screamed, "Do not intubate my husband," as they were in the process of getting ready to do it. When he heard her voice and her screaming, and no one will know to any day that they won't be able to do studies, but I can only surmise that whether it was an adrenaline pump or just hearing her voice shocked him into survivor mode. His oxygen levels came up, and he was not intubated, nor was he ever intubated, and he's alive to this day. And I attribute it to her dramatic appeal to the higher powers. I mean, it got pretty contentious to the point where they had to call the hospital administrator. She ended up in the emergency room herself with chest pain. It was quite dramatic. But just knowing that and him constantly asking for her whereabouts and her well-being, I think is alive today. I don't know how much time I have left, but I have done the research on hospital admissions, hospital discharges, and hospital readmissions, as well as outpatient post-hospitalization mortality. And there's not one study that isn't, I mean, they stopped doing studies a long time ago, to be honest with you, the 70s and 80s probably. But there's not one study that wouldn't hands down not request the presence of the next of kin or designated care provider, whether it's a tag team situation. Sometimes it takes two. And even for a minute, actually, for a minute, it defies all level of consciousness and civility to deprive a parent of being present with a minor. That to me is unconscionable, and it should be punishable by incarceration. Absolutely, people's medical licenses should be revoked. Hospital administrators should be fired. That absolutely, in this day and age, should. I require a chaperone when I do a pap smear. Not having someone present with a minor. I mean, what have we become? I mean, that's, barbarians knew better than to do those kind of things. Are we less than medieval barbarians now? Like, what has our society become that I even have to testify today to what is known to be fact, medical fact. It's not even disputed. And in 1973, we passed a Patient's Bill of Rights that was strongly recommended, and hospitals do have to adapt it and modify it to their own. But patients already have a Bill of Rights. And if they aren't in a capacity that they can answer for themselves, and let's face it, what patient who requires hospitalization is of their full mental, physical, and medical capacity? It's absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible to be in your full capacity. Be hospitalized. You don't reach hospital criteria, hospitalization criteria, if you're 100% of your full faculties. You absolutely must have some of your standing. And there's not. And any of you,
Dr. Baylor,
I just had a minor procedure. Yes.
Yes.
Well done.
And could I ask you to kind of wrap up your testimony? We have three other bills that we need to consider this afternoon. Yes.
Well,
thank you.
I think I've said enough. I can provide anybody with any of the medical literature if you need support or any, you know, anything written, studies that have been performed. I'd be happy to provide those for you. But I undoubtedly, of course, support this bill.
Okay. Thank you. I think we're going to have to do some extra thinking about this bill, and we are a little bit short on time. But we have some questions quickly.
Through the
Representative
chair,
Sumner.
I had a question for the bill sponsor. So under Section 3, the Article 6, if you go down, Section 18.20.630, healthcare facility liability. You're precluding a state agency from taking action against a healthcare facility for prohibiting a visitor from entering an operating room, isolation unit, et cetera. So it did seem that most of the testimony was revolving around COVID and patients not being able to visit. But my understanding is that most hospitals had them in essentially what were COVID isolation wards. So would this bill actually address that situation?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, it is my understanding that there were a variety of situations of varying degrees of care where patients found themselves. So not all of the patients were in an isolation ward. But you do bring up a good point that we would not want to inadvertently exclude them from being able to be present in what would be considered a COVID isolation room. However, I do have a lot of people, constituents, telling me about just a regular hospital room where they were there overnight and did not get to have a support person. I have people in senior homes who for an extended period of time were not allowed to see a loved one at all. And the doctor had to prescribe this senior antidepressants because she was quickly failing. And because the senior care facility did not allow them to see their family, the doctor had to prescribe car rides with the daughter so that she could actually exit the building and be able to have time with her daughter because she was rapidly deteriorating. So there are a variety of places that patients will be seen and have had the right of a support person limited. But I do appreciate the insight into that specific question.
Okay. Follow up, if I could.
Quickly.
Yes. So, I mean, I could understand the need to occasionally not let people come into an isolation room if there was an outbreak of pneumonic plague or something with an extremely high mortality rate. But I'm just wondering how I think I would agree with the testifiers that it was inappropriate to restrict those in the case of COVID. But I wonder how we still allow the potential for you know, potentially isolating patients, but still do this and address what it seems to be the issue. So, yeah.
Thanks. Right. I think probably in the interest of time, because we have public testimony scheduled for one of the bills, and I think and we're going to have a lot to think about with this bill. So I think in the interest of time, we'll set this aside for now. Question, I guess, we can go on past five. What is the will of the committee? Pardon?
We're scheduled till six.
We're scheduled till six. Ah, okay. This is better. We have more time than I was thinking. All right. Other questions? Representative Sadler and then Representative Nino.
Thank you. This is actually through the chair to Dr. Baylor. Prior to 2020, prior to COVID, what were the Matsu Regional Medical Center's policies on the presence of what we're going to colloquially know as a support person? A lot of the information we've heard, a lot of the evidence and stories pertain to the COVID. Just what was the baseline before COVID?
The baseline was that, especially in critical care, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, because, you know, there's always visiting hours, but I don't think there was ever there being an exception to allowing at least one family member. In fact, so much so that every single room, patient room in the hospital had a bed that was available for a family member to stay with the patient. I've never seen a case, unless the patient was considered of sound mind and body and explicitly asked for no one to be with them, which was rare. I seriously can't ever remember maybe once or twice ever a patient wanting to be entirely alone. Mostly in those situations, it's because a patient's concerned about their own family. They're worried about their family member being exposed to too much or being exposed to too much bad information, you know, sad information. But outside of that, I can't think of ever there being an exception to the rule that, because it makes it, their job so much easier, to be honest with you, from bathing to dressing to eating meals to ensuring that the patient's medicines didn't fall on the floor to just helping people get up out of bed, being an extra pair of hands, being eyes and ears on the ground. It has never, ever been a problem, even in the emergency room, until this past pandemic. It's mind-boggling to me, to be honest with you. I hope that answers your question.
Dr. Baylor, just a quick follow-up. So I want to clarify, there was previously there was no limit at all on the presence of a support person in a hospital, whether it was emergency room or in their recovery room. Was there no place in a hospital where a support person could not go, ER? I'm sorry, OR?
Well, yeah, they couldn't go in the operating room, obviously, for obvious reasons. That would be too distracting to the personnel in the operating room, and because of things being sterile, et cetera. And in all of those other situations, like, for instance, it's intensive care unit, if a heart attack patient or somebody who's critically ill, visitors might be limited, you know, in a crash and burn situation because it's just hard. If you have six healthcare providers around the bedside, you don't really need an emotional family member right there either. But for the most part, in the recovery room, patients always had at least one up to two, but usually no more than two in a post-op area. That you would bring them back as soon because you want that person to be there when the patient is given instructions following a procedure, you know, the diagnosis, procedure, what we did and what we're going and instructions here, if they're being discharged or whatever, outcomes are definitely better. So in those situations, if the space is smaller, crowded, it's usually one person, but sometimes up to two. I've never seen more than two people brought back in a post-op situation. The operating room, I've never seen a situation where a family member is allowed because it's just, you know, inappropriate, unless it's a wake procedure and they need an interpreter. But, you know, searching my memory bank, that's only happened to me when I was in the Army and we had people from truck territories and they needed an interpreter. You know, that was back in the day, but...
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to look forward to probing that question a little bit more in the future.
Somebody at the bedside, unless they're actively in a resuscitative process. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
I think we'll leave it at that. We're going to have some other questions.
Okay.
Representative Mina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I first wanted to thank the bill sponsor for sharing your personal experience. I know that it's an incredibly vulnerable and terrifying thing to go through that. So just thank you for sharing, and also the experiences of your constituents. And in terms of the bill, something that stuck out to me, so a lot of the examples related around COVID and looking at page 2, lines 2 through 3. So when a facility, or in this case, a provider of emergency medical services has the procedures related to the support person, it also includes provisions describing any clinically necessary or reasonable restriction the provider may place on access to the patient. So my question is, let's say if a provider, and this language continues on, you know, it repeats on page 3, lines 2 through 3, and that's related to hospitals, mental health facilities, long-term care facilities, or hospice. And so if those entities, let's say if it was Matsui Regional Hospital and they have a support person procedure that says we place restrictions based on this level of COVID for a patient, would this bill not change that situation, or how would that work?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, first of all, thank you for acknowledging the personal stories of my constituents. I want to make it clear that was not my story, that was their story. With permission, I was able to share that. But to answer your question, I think the word here is reasonable. And it is what I want to make clear through this bill is that it is the intent of the legislature for the healthcare facilities to not limit the access of at least one support person to a patient or resident during their care, regardless of a pandemic, regardless of a declared disaster, because of the human dignity, and that their policies should reflect that intent. So the word reasonable would mean if there was an extreme situation that it would be detrimental to the care of that individual that is proven detrimental, that there could be, it could be argued that it would be reasonable for access to be restricted. But I think what we've seen, that one of the lessons learned through the pandemic, is that withholding a support person is not reasonable. We saw dramatic decline in individuals, and as the testimony provided, continued trauma of families and Alaskans that they are dealing with for a very, very long time. And so I hope that answers your question. I want to allow the healthcare facilities the flexibility to still do their job of caring for patients in a medically appropriate way, but also clarify the right of an individual to have a support person.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, and so if, let's say, if there's an instance, let's say like a pneumonic plague, where there is a high infectious rate, and a hospital says that we deem it to be clinically necessary to have restrictions there, would this bill allow that hospital to do that, or would that hospital then be able to be sued based on the civil liabilities section later on in the bill, sections on page 4, starting on line 13?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I don't believe that I am the best person to fully answer that question. But for the intent, is that the healthcare facility would have the ability to make that decision as long as it was reasonable and they treated every individual with equal visitation rights and equal rights to have a support person. What we've seen through the pandemic is that that was not the case. And there is testimony of an individual in Anchorage who was undergoing surgery, was an elder, was not sure if she was going to make it through, and she requested the presence of the hospital chaplain and was denied. So even a healthcare-approved, a hospital-approved chaplain was denied access to that individual during the pandemic. That, in my mind, is not reasonable, and believe that this bill would change actions like that.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox, and thank you, Representative Vance, for the presentation today and bringing some of these very important things to light. Certainly no dispute, I don't think, from most people about the importance and value of loved ones and people being with their loved ones, especially in a medical or critical care situation. I actually do share, however, some of the concerns brought forward by Representative Mina that this bill in its current iteration may not actually accomplish what you want it to do. I think you said it best just a second ago when you said, in my mind, this is not a reasonable restriction. However, it doesn't seem that this bill actually defines what is a reasonable restriction. And certainly throughout the pandemic, because that's where most of these issues really came to light, most healthcare facilities would have driven pretty hard on the clinically necessary component of the bill that Representative Mina mentioned on page 3, line 2, and in other places. So I do share that concern, and that might be some language that we'll look at. My question, though, is surrounding some of the changes to section, this is on page 4, 1826.10, around complaints to the Commissioner of Health, and 1826.20 about civil liability. It's my understanding that both of these options are already in existence through the Department of Health to file a complaint. So if this bill were to become law, both of those things would essentially be redundant. Is that something that you would be able to speak to?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I have not been made aware of the redundancy, but I am more than willing to work with the committee on what on if this redundancy occurs and the need to simply state that this statute would be part of the provision of the health commissioner's investigative authority, as well as allowing civil liability. And to your previous statement, also finding clarifying what a reasonable restriction looks like. So I trust that with the counsel of many comes wisdom, that we can find what the right fit is for this bill. I'm willing to work with the committee on what that looks like.
Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, one situation that has been brought to my attention by some ER physicians is that there are some cases where there are patients that are actually in situations of human trafficking, domestic violence, and you know, the provider in that situation has an ability to separate an abuser or someone in that situation. So I was really pleased to see that on page 4, starting on line 3, there is a specific provision underneath the section relating to minors that the healthcare facility can't separate the minor from the support person, except in cases of suspected abuse, threats of violence, or to prevent disruption in the care of the minor. I'm wondering if there's a specific reason why this type of language is not replicated in the other sections related to facilities and to providers of emergency medical services.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, if you turn the page to page 5, on starting on line 7, AS 4762, a healthcare facility may restrict access of a person to a patient or resident at the request of the patient or law enforcement agency or according to a court order. And C, on line 10, if a healthcare facility has restricted physical access to a patient or resident, the healthcare facility shall allow the patient access to visitors through telecommunication. The intent with this is, as you've highlighted, to make sure that their safety and well-being is being safeguarded, because there are times through situations that you mentioned where it would not be helpful for them to have another person there because of other unforeseen circumstances.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see that language then also in page 5 as well. And so it looks like the difference between that section on starting on page 5, line 7, and so they can restrict access at the request of a patient or law enforcement agency or according to a court order. And so it would have to be on the patient and the agency or court order for that facility to be able to restrict access in case of some sort of, you know, potentially dangerous situation. But then going back to page 4 on line 3, they don't need a court order. They don't need the request of the patient. And so I do wonder in those situations where if there is a potentially like an abusive situation where a provider might be able to separate, it seems like this removes that ability for that provider to make that decision, which they can do in the status quo.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, for clarification, and I see where you're going with this question of different abused situations. The individual, the patient may not be able to speak freely. So are you asking that the provision on page 4 under number 3 be mirrored full in the other section?
Yes.
Yes, I think through the chair that is a great idea, and I think that can easily be accommodated.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Well, I think we will set this aside for further consideration and bring it up again at a later date. Thank you for bringing this bill to us, and thank you for the people that testified today. And it's a difficult subject that will take a lot of thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of committee.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Next, we have HB 6, Opioid Awareness Programs in Public Schools, and that I believe is by Representative Rauscher. And Representative Rauscher, would you like to come forward and present your bill? And please state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Representative George Rauscher. I represent District 29. I'd like to thank the committee and the chair for hearing this bill. I appreciate it that you found it important enough to hear. The HB 6, an act relating to the duties of the Department of Education and Early Development, relating to public education, relating to to opioid abuse awareness and prevention, and providing for an effective date. House Bill 6 addresses the need to better educate the youth in Alaska on the dangers of opioid misuse. Many communities around Alaska are feeling the impacts of the rising misuse of opioids and an increase in fentanyl-related deaths. This legislation would instruct the Department of Education and Early Development to put in place a 60-minute curriculum that would cover opioid abuse awareness and prevention. This curriculum would be for students grades 6 through 12 cover information about the dangers of using opioids, awareness of opioids that target children, and early warning signs related to the opioid addiction, amongst other things. The department would also be directed to consult with other entities around the state that have experience in dealing with opioid-related problems. Some of these groups would include Department of Health, state and tribal entities, the family members of individuals who had opioid overdose, and House Bill 6 would educate our children on the dangers of opioid use and help prepare them to deal with this ever-growing danger in Alaska. This bill that we're talking about here is fentanyl is going to be a problem in the state. The fentanyl is becoming a big problem in the lower 48. It's coming in the forms of Skittles looking objects, very tantalizing for kids to look at and want to possibly experiment with. There are things that are going on in this the drug world that is taking kids by subtly, but it's slowly moving in, and this piece of legislation deals with that aspect of it and wants to deal with being able to head off that aspect before kids start to take by number here in the state. At this point, I'd like to turn this discussion over to my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee. He's going to give you a sectional, and then there's also invited testimony.
Mr. McKee.
All right. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. Section 1, AS 14. .30 adds a new section to explain the awareness and prevention curriculum for students in grades 6 through 12. Then details are provided on who will be consulted and how the curriculum will be developed. Section 2, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, is amended by adding a new section related to deed regulations. Section 3, AS 14.30.363C. Enacted by Section 1, the effective date is September 1st, 2023. And then Section 4, with exception to Section 3 of this act will take effect immediately. And then we have Michael Kaysen, I believe, online for invited testimony to talk a little bit more about the curriculums that are available and a little bit more about the history of the opioid epidemic.
Hey, Mr. Carson. Can you hear us?
Yes, Michael Carson. I am the vice president and the recovery specialist at My House of Matsu, a runaway drop-in center. I also chair the Matsu Opioid Task Force and currently sit on the State Opioid Steering Committee. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of HB 6 to this committee regarding opioid awareness in public schools. First things first, I want to acknowledge Representative Rauscher for his filing of HB 6. And I wanted to bring you up to date on some of the data that is surrounding the opioid epidemic. The first phase had to do with pain pills. Then we moved into the second phase, heroin, and now we're in the third phase dealing with fentanyl. And all ages, 15 to 44 years old, have all saw increases in overdoses, and that's with 25 to 35-year-olds with the greatest increase. All public school students will eventually be in that greatest risk age group. In fact, the year 2021, Alaska had the largest jump in drug overdoses nationally. And one out of three Alaskans have been directly affected by the opioid epidemic. You all must be well aware of the drug bust last week at the Juneau Airport. They seized 5,000 oxy counterfeit pills at a street value of $150,000. The DEA has just released their newest lab results, and they are now saying that 6 out of 10 counterfeit pills have a potential lethal dose. 5,000 pills, that would be a potential of 3,000 fatal overdoses or poisonings, because it only takes 2 milligrams of fentanyl to be fatal. 1 gram would kill 500 people. In fact, a half a pill could kill. I believe it is imperative to get the most current and accurate drug information to our youth, because everything now is contaminated with fentanyl. Heroin, cocaine, meth, Percocet pills, Xanax, Oxys, and even Adderall. There is nothing safe. No drug is safe unless it comes directly from a doctor or a licensed pharmacist. Yet I believe this information also needs to include parents. Parents are a vital partner in the education of their children. Now, regarding curriculum, unfortunately, there is no current health curriculum that addresses opioids, much less fentanyl. The last time the health curriculum has been revised was prior COVID, and there is no mention of opioid tolerance, dependence, or addiction. In fact, the DEED e-learning platform or resources for teachers doesn't even have any updated fentanyl information. In this bill, we are asking that curriculum be developed and created. However, I am suggesting in the interim to utilize Kelsey's lesson, which has the objective how opioids hack and whack the brain. This lesson is aligned with national adolescent health standards, working with the CDC over an 8-month period. You might ask what my qualifications are to write that lesson. I taught 35 years in the Mat-Su School District. I taught 8 at Mat-Su College. I have composed curriculums, so in scope and sequences and syllabi. I have postgraduate work in addiction studies. I worked with the Division of Juvenile Justice for 20 years. I've been with the My House Drive-In Center as recovery specialist for 12. And again, the Mat-Su Opioid Task Force for 6 years, and most recently with the state. I would welcome any questions that you may have regarding opioids, fentanyl, and Kelsey's lesson. Again, thank you for this opportunity to testify in such an important, important issue that is facing all Alaskans. May they be youth, may they be parents, or may they be seniors. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I also have Dr. Cutchins on the list. Is he just here to answer questions, or
we're not aware?
Oh, okay. All right. With that, do we have any questions for the representative, Ms. Representative Mina?
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, are there any other drug education programs that are statewide? I looked into the statutes kind of related to, I guess, the DEED area. And I know, I mean, I recall going through Drug Free Week in fourth grade at ASD, but I don't know if there is a precedent for any other types of drug education.
Representative Rauscher, for the record, through the chair, Representative Mina, I'm going to ask Dr. Carson whether or not the answer for that question.
Dr. Carson, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did, and through the chair. We are actually asking, and that is a great question about Red Ribbon Week. Red Ribbon Week is the last week of October. It's a national drug prevention campaign, and we are asking that this lesson, this 30-minute lesson, be taught during that week. However, that is all dependent on individual schools, school districts, and principals on if that is something that they would like to present during Red Ribbon Week. Okay. I was able to, this past year, present at Colony Middle School and Colony High School, and I was able to present during Red Ribbon Week specifically on the issue of fentanyl and letting them know that fentanyl is 50 times more powerful than heroin, 100 times more powerful than morphine, and again, only 2 milligrams are fatal. And as Representative Rauscher mentioned, I'm sure you have heard of rainbow fentanyl coming in the form of sweet tarts, Skittles, Nerds, sidewalk chalk.
Okay, thank you.
And so I just wanted to make sure that youth had that, and that week is designated to drug prevention.
Great. Okay, thank you. Do you have a follow-up? Yes. Representative Mina.
Yes, I had a follow-up related to this for the invited presenter. What are the rates of opioid abuse among youth in Alaska, an overdose, and how does that compare to the national average?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. As I mentioned, in the year 2021, Alaska had the largest jump for drug overdoses. And all ages from 15 to 40 saw that increase, which the 25 to 34-year-olds had the greatest increase. I could provide you with some specific numbers by contacting Jessica Philly with the Department of Health and Social Services to bring you the most current. I'm sure you're aware that the reporting lags behind. I know the CDC has put out information, 108,000 people.
Would you be able to get that information to us and send it to the committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Reach out to Jessica, and we can get that information to you so that you know exactly how that breaks down to, for different age groups. But I had mentioned that all our 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds are eventually going to be in that high-risk group of 25 to 34-year-olds. Okay. I just think it's imperative to move upstream. I am all about pulling people out of the river of addiction, getting them to detox and treatment, but there's something to say about moving upstream and cutting off the flow of the river of addiction.
Yep. If you could get those statistics to us and just send it to the Health and Social Services Committee, we'd appreciate it.
Yes, I can do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Carson, you presented us evidence. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot of additional evidence about the dangers of drugs, specifically about fentanyl. The question on the table is, should there be a specific curriculum aimed at opioid awareness? And my colleague to the left of me, Representative Mina, asked a general question. I'm going to ask a little more pointed. Is there any kind of drug, a generic drug abuse curriculum, not abuse of generic drugs, mind you, but just other drug abuse curriculum that currently is required to be presented to Alaska public school students?
Not that I'm aware of. And I just want to clarify, my name is just Mr. Carson. I'm not a doctor. I am only aware with some research that currently maybe only the state of Maryland has any school curriculum that they are presenting currently. I am not aware of any mandated drug curriculum in the state of Alaska. I know we have Breeze Law, which has to do with dating violence. We have Aaron's Law, which has to do with sexual assault. But there is no mandated drug curriculum, and I believe that is due to there is no law requiring that. Okay. And again, that is all up to individual school districts, could be up to individual principals, counselors, and nurses.
Okay.
So there's nothing uniform or universal that I am aware of.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
Through the chair, I do hope we can get someone with the Department of Education and Early Development to answer that question. Having been through the 70s and the 80s and the just say no's, I would be very surprised to know there was not some mandated education about drug abuse. And I guess if it does come to pass, there is not, and this bill makes progress, I don't know if we would not want to broaden it away from specifically opioid abuse. Hallucinogens, psychedelics are also a danger as well.
Great. Thank you. Representative Sumner.
So through the chair to the bill sponsor, I do recall the DARE program, and I could be wrong, but my understanding is that was discontinued because it was an abject failure. It sort of had a perverse impact of while it was educating children about drugs. Well, first of all, I don't think there was any evidence that it reduced drug use, but there was potentially some evidence that it increased drug use. So I guess maybe I would like to go back and take a look and see if there was any research on that. I mean, I do agree that there's a massive problem with opioids in the state of Alaska, and something needs to be done. And this is something, but that doesn't mean this needs to be done. So if you guys are aware of any research that shows drug education programs have had a beneficial impact, I would certainly love to see that. Thank you.
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair to Representative Sumner, I do not have that information. You did use the word potential, but I will look into it. I will find out everything I can tell you about what you're talking about. I think that if there's information out there, we will find it, and I will present it to the committee, I promise.
Okay. We will be looking forward to that. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, relating back to the bill, so it looks like the department creates the curriculum, and then it's up to the school districts to teach the curriculum. And so I have two questions. Number one, is this like an assembly where everybody in the school just learns this for 60 minutes within this week? I guess my question is, like, who's teaching it, if there's an idea of that? And then second, you know, the language is that, you know, this is for students in grades 6 through 12. Is this every year, or is this, like, one time between grades 6 through 12? Thank you.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Mina, I'm going to take a real quick stab at the answer. First off, I believe it is not up to us to design the curriculum, nor is it us to design the timing, nor is it designed for us to tell them how to present it. That is for the schools to the curriculum to be adopted by the school districts. But I will turn that question over to Mr. Carson, and I believe the answer is going to be possibly the same.
Mr. Carson?
Yes, thank you for the question, and I just wanted to back up a little bit. The representative that was mentioning the DARE program, he was absolutely correct. That program did not produce the outcomes, targeted benchmarks that it was designed to do. And what I personally, as an educator, believe is that regarding the question about how often I believe due to the ever-changing horizon of the drug epidemic, as I mentioned, now we're in the third phase, that things are changing so rapidly that I believe it is important that students would receive this once a year, and I would suggest during Red Ribbon Week. This could happen in of schools assemblies. I've done assemblies where I've had an entire grade level in a theater. I've also taught this lesson in individual health classes. So that would be decided upon each school district on how they believe would be the best and effective way to be able to provide the most current and accurate information on drugs. I do concur with the representative that was talking about other drugs, because we know that, as I mentioned in my presentation, that fentanyl has contaminated heroin, cocaine, and meth, Percocet. So all of that information about those different kinds of drugs would be very important. And I believe, again, once a year, just because everything is changing. In Kelsey's lesson, I have an addendum on fentanyl, and I have to update it every 2 weeks. And one was just this last episode that happened in the Juneau airport. Previous to that was 2 weeks earlier in Skagway, and a month or two earlier what happened in Kodiak, and then last March what happened in Mat-Su, where we had 8 fatal overdoses due to a bad batch of heroin and 21 emergencies.
Okay. So thank you.
It is always changing.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? All right, did you have any final comments, Representative Rauscher?
Oh, I appreciate it very much, Chairman Prox, but I do want to bring up, there's an article, March 1st, and CBS News put it out, how Alaska became one of fentanyl's deadliest frontiers. Just to give you an awareness of what we're dealing with here in the state of Alaska. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so we're going to set this aside for further consideration. And at this time, we'll take up HB 56. Oops. Representative Rauscher.
You're
gone. At ease. Okay, we're back on record, and we have HB 56, sponsored by Representative Ruff-Ridge, and that has to do with exempting veterinarians from the Controlled Substance Database. Representative Ruff-Ridge.
Well, thank you, Chair Prox and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Justin Ruff-Ridge, and I am going to present to you today on House Bill 56, after I'm done, and with my Chief of Staff, Bud Sexton. He will present the sectional analysis, and then we do have in person today Dr. Tracy Ward, past president of the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association, for an invited testimony as well. Also on the line for questions, if needed, we have Dr. Michaela Dick, Dr. Sarah Coburn, and Dr. Jim Delker. So, House Bill 56 is a bill to exempt veterinarians from the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. So I will just briefly give an introduction on what the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program is. It was initially established in this state in 2008 with Senate Bill 196, and it was developed to track the dispensing of controlled substance medications in the state. It has since gone through many iterations and different legislative processes, but its initial intent was to help professionals in the medical fields to track the dispensing of controlled substances in the state. At the moment, all 50 states do have a drug monitoring program of some sort. The most recent addition to that is Missouri in 2021, is the last state to join having a prescription drug monitoring program. At this time, 33 other states who have a PDMP program have gone through this process of exempting veterinarians from their PDMP for the reasons that I will give you later on in this presentation, and our invited testimony will also describe for you in detail. Currently in Alaska, all prescribing license types by statute are required to register with the PDMP. This is an online application through your licensing boards. We are also statutorily required to review the prescription drug monitoring program prior to prescribing any controlled substance. And then as dispensers of controlled substances, they are required to report daily the dispensing of all controlled substances in the state. And that reporting is also due even on days where you are not in business, including holidays and weekends. You must submit a zero report, and obviously this includes veterinarians. As I said before, Alaska's PDMP was initially designed to be a tool to aid practitioners with the intent to give practitioners a clear, consistent dispensing record, especially in relation to Class II narcotic substances. So these are highly abusable medications, and the DEA classifies those in their highest class that are not illicit drugs, which would be Class I. But Class II includes medications like oxycodone, hydrocodone, fentanyl, like we just heard in the previous presentation, and hydrocodone. However, this prescription drug monitoring program does not just collect data on Class II controlled substances, but all dispensed controlled substances, including medications like testosterone, which is a Class III controlled substance, Zolpidem or Ambien, a sleeping medication, Class IV controlled substance, phenobarbital, which is an older barbiturate medication, which is human medication but used in animals for seizure control. Lyrica, commonly used medication for fibromyalgia, which is a Class V controlled substance. All of these are reported to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Dispensers, as I mentioned before, are required to report daily or send in a zero report. For some entities, like pharmacies, this is an automatic process. For veterinarians who do not dispense controlled substances on a regular basis, and we'll talk about that a little later in the presentation, they're required to manually go online and submit a zero report, which is actually quite a cumbersome process. One of the major intents of the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, so we don't get confused about its intent, it does not have any ability to control illicit drug use. So some of the drug overdoses that we are hearing about as far as deaths in this state as a result of illegal fentanyl, illicit drugs that look like prescription medications, so imported drugs like the drug bust that was at the Juneau Airport. The Prescription Drug Monitoring Program has no bearing or ability to catch illicit drug use. This is only designed to monitor prescription drugs that are legally written for by a prescription from a practitioner and then dispensed through a pharmacy or dispensed in some other manner. And it, one of the techniques that was used prior to the implementation of these programs was doctor shopping or pharmacy shopping, which is the practice of going to multiple doctors over the short period of time and then getting those prescriptions filled at multiple pharmacies in order to essentially double or triple or quadruple up on the amount of medications you can get. That practice has all but ceased with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program and the ability of pharmacies and physicians to see prior to dispensing what medications someone has been dispensed. So what is the problem and what does this bill solve? Veterinarians are obviously very aware of the importance of the prescription drug monitoring program and the ability to stop doctor and pharmacy shopping, as I mentioned before. But veterinarians do experience very unique difficulties with the current program requirements, and there are very serious concerns about the privacy of people's information inside of the prescription drug monitoring program. The PDMP is absolutely designed to track human prescriptions. It is not designed to track animal prescriptions for a number of reasons. And the data that is gathered is often not linked to any specific animal owner, which is what would be required in order for the prescription drug monitoring program to accurately track dispensing data for animals. However, viewing a pet owner's prescription information in the prescription drug monitoring program raises some major privacy concerns. One, because veterinarians are not governed by HIPAA law, nor are they trained in human medicine. And so before making a decision as to whether or not to dispense any controlled substance to a veterinary patient, an animal of some sort, a veterinarian is required to look up that owner or whoever is currently in the office seeking care for their pet. To look up that person's information, as well as look up whether or not that information may have been tied to an animal and at some previous dispensing. So the data is actually incredibly not accurate at the moment. In addition, many pet owners are not aware that veterinarians would have any access to any of their personal medical information. And so when made aware of that, that is certainly a concern for many veterinary patients. As I said, currently animal patients are not well tracked through the PDMP, and that's for a number of reasons. First, animal patients typically lack unique identifiers that the PDMP uses for you to even look up a patient to begin with. If you are a user of the PDMP, you will know that the first thing you have to do in order to find information on any individual is to look them up by their last name and their date of birth. Both things that animals sometimes struggle to have with any regularity. So what do? You look up the animal's owner, which you may have multiple owners, typically a family, sometimes a neighbor or some sort of responsible party. That animal may have been owned by one person, then adopted out to another. It can be very confusing to know which responsible party you are to look up at that moment. And rarely do any of those owners know any of the exact information for those animals. In addition, veterinary use of narcotics is incredibly low. This is not a high user of class 2 controlled substances. In fact, in a recent study from 2017, it showed that throughout the United States, veterinary opioid dispensing accounted for only 0.34% of all opioid dispensing in the United States. And usually this is as a subset of surgery. It is not a large quantity of narcotic products at all. And opioid dispensing is typically reserved for pharmacies, in fact, not typically dispensed out of a veterinary office at all. In summary, exempting veterinarians from the PDMP will protect human patient privacy, which is something that I believe should be of importance to the legislature. Exempting veterinarians ensures that PDMP data is clear and usable and linked to those end users only. And I certainly would welcome your questions and certainly hope that you would join me in supporting House Bill 56 to exempt veterinarians from the PDMP. Happy to answer questions. And first, I think I'll have Mr. Sexton go through the sectional, make sure you guys understand what's in there.
For the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Ruffridge. Excuse me. Section 1 is amended to remove the Board of Veterinary Examiners from the notification requirement when a practitioner registers with a database. Section 2 is amended by adding a new subsection that this section does not apply to Schedule 2, 3, or 4 controlled substances prescribed or dispensed by a veterinarian under statute to treat an animal. And Section 3 is repealed, which removes the requirement for veterinarians under the Controlled Substance Prescription Database.
Okay, thank you.
And, yeah, it's up to the chair. Certainly welcome to answer questions or have invited testimony.
I think we have invited testimony that we probably should hear.
Thank you.
And please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Tracy Ward. I am a practicing veterinarian here in Juneau at Juneau Animal Rescue, the local shelter. I'm also the immediate past president of the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association. My colleague, Dr. Rachel Berngard, was supposed to be here as well to testify on behalf of the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Dr. Berngard is also a lawyer and is currently stuck in, not stuck, but is delayed in a trial that was postponed yesterday because of the weather. So I will be presenting and answering questions on behalf of both the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association and the Board of Veterinary Examiners today. Representative Ruffridge did a great job of summarizing the situation, and I apologize in advance. There is some duplication between his presentation and mine, so I'll try to skip over the redundant parts and open up for questions as soon as possible. Just wanted to state for the record that both the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association and the Alaska Board of Veterinarians strongly support House Bill 56, the exemption of veterinarians from the Controlled Substance Database. As well, the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, the agency that administers the PDMP, has passed a motion to support exemption of veterinarians as of last February. For those of you who aren't aware, Representative Ruffridge did a great job reviewing the history of the PDMP. The key point from a veterinarian standpoint is that in 2017, when the PDMP was amended to require mandatory participation by all federal DEA permit holders, veterinarians were not consulted prior to this amendment being enacted. Representatives, you can see in the photo here, representatives from the prescribing boards of all other prescribing agencies were consulted and were on a committee drafting the amendment. Neither the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association or the Board of Veterinary Examiners were included. But we were included in the amendment, which requires all federal DEA registrants to prescribe, administer, or dispense Schedule 2 through 4 controlled substances to participate. As Representative Ruffridge mentioned, the PDMP simply is not a workable database because our patients aren't humans, they're animals, and the system is designed to be queried and reported based on human data. Animals don't have a unique identifier, such as a social security number. We often don't know their birthday. Their name can change during the course of their lives. The ownership can change. So we query based on the human that brings them to the veterinary clinic. This data is not the human's data. Is not usable by veterinarians for a very important reason. We are not trained in human pharmacology. So even if I were to be trying to interpret data to decide if the person who brought me an animal I'm considering prescribing controlled substances for should be a concern, I don't have the knowledge of whether what is an appropriate dose, an appropriate length of time for a prescription, the number of refills. And veterinarians know very well from our experience with essentially every other species besides humans that appropriate drug dosages and treatment times can vary tremendously between species. So it really is not, we're not able to interpret the data that we do see regarding the human owner. And I've not talked to a veterinarian yet who has taken that data and used it to modify what they're going to do for the patient in front of them if they feel that they need a controlled substance. So we're essentially being required to query data that we're unable to interpret or make use of. And as Representative Ruffridge very eloquently stated, this is at best intrusive and is definitely an invasion of the human's privacy because they are not our patient, they are our client. And so we are not protected by HIPAA regulations with the human owner. I would ask the representatives to have a glance at the list of some common medications that would be seen when you query someone's controlled drug history and ask yourself if you would like someone who is not whom you don't enjoy client-patient privilege with to have access to that information. It definitely makes veterinarians uncomfortable. We are often asked, well, if we take you out of PDMP, how are you being monitored as regards to controlled substances? And the answer is we are very strictly monitored by the Drug Enforcement Agency. Veterinarians who prescribe or dispense controlled substances have a significant level of accountability and record keeping around purchasing, dispensing, administering these medications. These, I literally have to account for every pill of oral medication that I dispense, every drop of injectable medication that I administer. And those records must be made available to the DEA or to local law enforcement upon request. In addition, distributors of controlled substances are required to monitor use patterns of purchases of controlled drugs. There's something in place called the Suspicious Order Monitoring System, that where data is gathered by the distribution companies, and they are required by the DEA to monitor and report unusual purchase patterns. In other words, if a veterinarian changes the patterns and their purchases of controlled substances, and it falls outside of the norm of their previous history, or as compared to a practice of similar size and scope, that is, those purchases are flagged and forwarded to the DEA for investigation. And this is how the vast majority of the few diversion situations are actually caught, not by the PDMP. As Representative Ruffridge mentioned, we are not making a unique ask here. 33 other states exempt veterinarians from the PDMP, 23 of which never required veterinarians from participating from the beginning, and 10 that formally mandated veterinary reporting but repealed inclusion due to the reasons that we're discussing today. And as was already discussed, 1/3 of 1% of total opioid prescriptions that were dispensed by retail pharmacies in 2017 were veterinary prescriptions. So even if we were to imagine that every single veterinary opioid prescription was misused, it still accounts for a tiny, tiny drop in the bucket of the total opioid abuse problem. And the reason for that is simply, as is shown in the graph, that veterinarians don't use the drugs of concern. We almost never use the synthetic opioids in veterinary practice. Vicodin, OxyContin are not used ever. Fentanyl would be the only one in that class that is used, and that is used almost exclusively in the hospital. In other words, it's not sent home with the pet owner. It's administered by the veterinarian directly to the animal while they are hospitalized, usually following an extremely painful procedure such as back surgery or another orthopedic procedure. We don't use cocaine in vet clinics or psychostimulants such as methamphetamine. So we are not the source of the drugs that are of concern in this epidemic. If our participation was, Representative Ruffridge and I have both already mentioned, our participation is not really helping the problem because we are not the source of the drugs of concern. But if it wasn't causing any other, problem or I'm at a loss for the words here. I'm into Dr. Burkert's part of the slides here. Or any other hardship on veterinarians, we probably wouldn't be as aggressively pursuing this bill as we are. But the fact of the matter is that violations of the PDMP, even clerical or mistakes in trying to query the system, stimulate an investigation of veterinarians for improper use by the Board of Veterinary Examiners. As you can see from this slide here, since veterinary participation in the PDMP became mandatory, the cost to the Board of Veterinary Examiners to investigate veterinarians for violations has increased over threefold. And that is, again, not because veterinarians are misusing the drugs, but because they are unable to use an unwieldy system that doesn't communicate with our record-keeping system, and because it doesn't integrate with medical software and pharmacies. The costs of investigating the veterinarians are borne by veterinarians. The Board of Veterinary Examiners is not funded by the government. It's funded by licensing fees, which, for your information, Alaska already has the highest licensing fees for veterinarians in the country. So we are expecting those fees to increase if the cost of these PDMP investigations continues. So we are essentially charging veterinarians to investigate themselves for a system that they are unable to use. For the reasons myself and Representative Rushbridge have discussed, we are asking for your support of House Bill 56. It would allow us to continue to provide appropriate medical management for our patients. It will increase the efficacy of the PDMP for its intended purpose because it will take the inaccurate data that veterinarians are inputting out of the system, and it will allow us to continue to judiciously use controlled substances as we deem necessary. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Do we have any questions? Representative Sadler, then Representative Mina.
Through the chair, if you could roll back one slide, I just wanted to refer to the second bullet point there.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. I certainly, and Representative Rufford, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I was on the floor when we passed PDMP. It was a stressful time, and I will not aver that every consideration was given to the impact of that bill on veterinarians. So I can see clearly the benefit of exempting veterinarians, but the second bullet point there will increase the efficiency. Please elucidate a little bit more how exempting veterinarians from the system will help the system work better for its intended purpose. Not quite sure how I see that.
Thank you, Representative Sadler, through the chair. As I had said in my presentation, the prescription drug monitoring program was intended to stop practices of doctor shopping and pharmacy shopping. And so one of those, that practice was very common prior to the implementation of the PDMP. It was through, physicians, emergency rooms, dentist offices, and pharmacies seeing multiple patients and really having no way to track whether or not those patients had medications dispensed from some other source, that there was overprescribing of controlled substances that was happening really without any knowledge of that occurring. The efficiency of the PDMP system by exempting veterinarians cleans up the data. So at the moment, so a prescription for an animal can be in the PDMP three different ways. It can be in there as an animal with some unknown date of birth. Sometimes those date of births are either made up or different. It can be in there under, as Dr. Ward mentioned, a variety of different names, or it can be in there under a variety of owners. And so it does not allow for very accurate interpretation of data, and it's really impossible to trust the data that is existing in the PDMP when it comes to veterinary medicine, and really does not hold well to the intended purpose of the PDMP.
Okay. Short follow-up?
Short follow-up.
Very short. And if you could, through the chair, Dr. or Representative Rufford, just speak briefly about the effectiveness of the PDMP program for its intended use. Is that working well, do you think?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Representative Rufford, for the record, yes. Unfortunately, the overdose deaths in this state do continue to increase, and that is sometimes why the PDMP gets a sharper eye in its direction, essentially saying, are you doing your job, PDMP? Unfortunately, the PDMP is successful in diverting people away from doctor shopping and pharmacy shopping, but it does not stop people from seeking drug use. Illicit drug use now becomes the sought-after product. So in many cases, driving people away from pharmaceutical use in maybe an illicit fashion, which is what the PDMP was designed to stop, does drive up people's illicit use of drugs, such as heroin or fentanyl or oxycodone that is manufactured to look like pharmaceutical-grade oxycodone.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, it's been, I was following this bill as a staffer over the past couple of years, so And I think it is really significant to see the shift in a lot of the different former opposition folks, especially from the medical association, come to a position of neutrality. So I really do think the work of what has happened in the interim to get folks to that point. And so my question is, for veterinarians right now, what is that participation in like other like opioid task forces, et cetera, so that that conversation is being brought from the perspectives of your professionals?
For the record, Dr. Tracy Ward, through the chair. I think our feeling is that we feel that education of veterinarians is probably a more worthwhile endeavor than requiring participation in this system. We have added speakers from the Drug Enforcement Agency to our state veterinary medical conference to talk to us about what they're seeing as far as trends to help educate veterinarians. Although it is a very rare, we do want to make sure that veterinarians know what they should be looking for in case as far as behavior of someone trying to veterinary shop. There are a lot of reasons why that's quite uncommon, but it is still important that we understand the significance of what we should be watching for. There's also, I think, just as a general, as part of the larger medical community, understanding where those drugs are coming from. We've certainly seen an increase in security, for example, at veterinary clinics, making break-ins from people trying to find drugs on premises more difficult. And certainly in the last probably 5 years, we've seen quite an increase in clinics that are writing or calling in prescriptions to a pharmacy as opposed to carrying drugs on the controlled drugs on the premises and dispensing those. So there definitely are things that veterinarians can do to do our part in this epidemic. But as Representative Ruffridge said, the vast majority of this becoming illicit drugs, not the kind of things that we would be carrying in our clinics.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up?
Quickly.
Just out of curiosity, through the chair, so, you know, there's a really harrowing article in the New York Times a couple of months ago about xylazine and the presence of that type of drug, which is like a horse tranquilizer that they mix with fentanyl to create like the tranq dope. And, you know, from my other meetings that I've had, there aren't a lot of cases of that here in Alaska. So I'm just curious of like, what's that conversation and outlook looking like, knowing that is a little bit separate from the P2MP. But okay, yeah,
certainly, Dr. Ward, through the chair. That is currently, xylazine is not a controlled substance. My understanding is that federally, it's probably going to become a controlled substance soon. I would be surprised if it were a significant problem in Alaska, primarily because its primary use in veterinary medicine is on the large animal side, equine and bovine. And while there are obviously cattle and horses in Alaska, the proportion of those, because of our climate, is small in regards to if you think about states like Oklahoma or Texas or Nebraska. So there's certainly less, you know, many veterinary clinics don't even carry xylazine for in-house use. So it's difficult for me to comment on what the impact would be in Alaska.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Another Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, so in the worst case scenario, what even are the veterinary drugs of concern for diversion? I mean, what are veterinarians prescribing that even might be a concern for conversion?
Certainly, through the chair. The primary veterinary drug that would be, there are two opioids that we use most commonly, hydrocodone would probably be the most concerning. That is typically used for chronic coughs in dogs. There's a condition primarily in very small dogs, like Yorkshire Terriers, called collapsing trachea, that results in a chronic cough that occasionally progresses to the point where over-the-counter cough suppressants don't control it, and the animal needs to be prescribed hydrocodone. It would be, you know, very small amounts, the kind of it's cough syrup essentially. So, and for a 10-pound dog, you'd pretty much have to losing your dog's prescription on a daily basis to access enough of it to cause a serious issue. The second most common opioid that we use in-house would be something called buprenorphine, which is used as a pain medication, and it is actually used to treat fentanyl addiction.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Any closing thoughts? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Just appreciate the hearing of this bill today. Certainly, this is an important aspect of ensuring that our data is safe and effective in the PDMP. Certainly, from my perspective, there is some additional work on the PDMP that I plan on doing in my time here, so this will not be the first time that you hear me say the phrase PDMP, and I'm sorry for that, but it's a very important system, and it's something that I think can be used at a much greater level, but we need to get through this portion first and make sure that our data is good and clean and vets are able to do their jobs efficiently, so veterinarians, so people aren't confused, sorry, vets and veterinarians. But yes, thank you, and certainly happy to talk more about this offline.
Okay, and with that, we will set this bill aside for further consideration and public testimony. And thank you very much. All right, so next we have HB 17, contraceptive coverage. Deals with insurance and medical assistance. I'd like to invite Representative Carrick and her staff, Sherry Bowman, to come forward to the table, introduce yourselves for the record, and bring us up to speed. And we are going to have public testimony, I believe, today as well.
Thank you. Through the chair and for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. Thanks for having House Bill 17 in front of you again. And just wanted to give a brief recap that this is an insurance bill mandating insurance coverage of up to 12 months of prescription contraceptives dispensed at one time. It's, as a recap, still the provider's prerogative whether to dispense that amount of birth control or not, and providers can already dispense up to 12 months supply of contraceptives. And this just helps to clarify that the bill doesn't change the amount of times you see your doctor, but does change potentially the number of times you need to go and see your pharmacist. During the last hearing, a few questions did come up, and committee members received answers to those questions on February 14th. My staff and I would be happy to address any further questions the committee has if desired, and we do have a couple of folks on the line, Division of Insurance Specialist Sarah Bailey and Charles Sending, I believe that says, at the Division of Health Services, and they are available to take any questions the committee might have as well, and then we do have, I believe, some public testimony.
Okay, do we have any questions? And you have a better idea because your script didn't match mine. Of others that were invited testimony?
To the chair, we just had a couple of last-minute, I think, changes in who was actually available from the departments for questions, but they're not here for invited testimony, just for potential questions.
Yeah. All right, very good. And I don't see anyone in the room for public testimony, but I guess I need to open for public testimony and then say that. So we will open public testimony at this time. And I don't see anyone in the room for public testimony, but do we have those who are online? And I do not have this. Let me go. 17. Do that. Right. First, I have Barbara Tindall from North Pole. Barbara, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Please go ahead. You have
all right.
3 minutes.
Thank you for allowing for testimony on HB 17. I want to thank this committee. And I am speaking in opposition to this bill, unless amended, and perhaps it has been, to exclude the emergency contraceptive piece from the language. Providing contraceptives does not cause me concern, but the emergency contraceptive does. In an article titled, "Is Emergency Contraception Different from the Abortion Pill?" explains that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, ACOG, voted in 1959 to redefine pregnancy, changing its definition from the moment of fertilization to the moment of implantation to the wall of the uterus. And I believe life begins at conception. To provide a pill that does not allow a fertilized embryo to adhere to the uterus is abortion. The article goes on to state its emergency contraception, talking about them, primary function is to prevent ovulation. However, the manufacturer's insert for Plan B admits that the product may prevent the implantation of an already fertilized human embryo. That possibility is not acceptable, and no insurance policy should be forced to pay for it. So please amend this bill to exclude emergency contraception before voting on it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Tindall? Thank you. And next we have Sarah, insurance specialist with the Division of Insurance. Sarah Bailey, I'm sorry. Ah, never mind. Questions. There we go. And so then we'll go to Pamela Samash, Right to Life Interior Alaska from Nenana.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Hello, my name is Pamela Samash, and I live in Nenana, Alaska. I would like a no vote on HB 17, and here's the reasons why. First of all, the government's role is not to force private enterprises to do anything. That's not their job. The job of the government is to protect rights, is to protect our rights from government overstep. So it's not appropriate for the government to tell a private enterprise insurance company what to do. If the role of that is that the way it's supposed to work is the insurance company decides what they will tell people what they have to offer, and then we decide if we want to accept it or not. That's how capitalism works. Okay, the government is not, we're not a socialist country, we're not a communist country. We're a capitalist country, and we're supposed to be able to have our private businesses without government's interference. So that's the first reason. The second reason is the day after pill is killing a child, and that's murder, and the government is supposed to protect life, not kill people. And the third reason is I would like to remind everybody on the committee that there is a workforce shortage currently happening in Alaska. It's severe. We have elderly people who are hungry because they can't even get food stamps because of the SNAP program, because of a workforce shortage. And I don't know about you, but I'm not getting any younger. And if we keep killing our future generation, who is going to take care of us? Okay, so we need to think about math. We can't argue with math. We need to stop killing children. This bill is saturated in death, okay? It's all about preventing babies, killing babies, death, death, death. That's what this whole bill is about to me. And you need all of anything to do with death or taking away private enterprise rights needs to be out of this bill, so whatever's left. Over 60% of abortions are now chemical abortions. We are literally murdering our entire next generation. But then we're saying we don't have enough employees. It's so bad that the governor had to take off the, you know, the school requirements for state jobs, the Bar Association had to lower their requirements for people to become lawyers. I mean, we're really desperately in a we're in a crisis, and this is why, because we won't let people live beyond the womb. So please completely destroy this bill, end it. Any bill that kills our future generation needs to go. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Samish?
Sure.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Ms. Samish, just wanted to clarify, are you speaking for yourself or as a member of an organization?
I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
Through the chair, just curious, are you speaking on your own behalf or on behalf of Right to Life Alaska?
I'm not with Right to Life Alaska. I'm with Right to Life Interior Alaska. I'm the president and on my own behalf as well, because I'm also, even I'm speaking on my behalf and on behalf of the Right to Life Interior Alaska, but I'm also a commissioner on the Aging Commission, even though I'm not speaking on behalf of that commission. And I'm fully aware that our elderly population is exploding and we do not have enough people to take care of us. So we are in a crisis situation and we need to go into crisis mode. And so that's, I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you, Ms. Samash. And next I have Catherine Christensen. Ms. Christensen, are you still online?
Sorry, this is my first time.
That's fine. We can hear you perfectly well. Please start your testimony.
I just have the concern that telling the insurance companies what to do with all the trouble that we've had with insurance companies just puts people at risk of not getting medical care that they need. I have some friends that left their insurance company because they were concerned about birth control being mandated for insurance companies. And they went with a program where they paid in and they... It wasn't really an insurance company, so they couldn't sue them when they weren't covered and their son had to have brain surgery. And, you know, they just were like, oh, this isn't covered under our program. So I'm just concerned about these types of bills being put forward and saying, like, hey, we're going to limit what an insurance company can do or can't do or control it. I really feel like if we're, as Alaskans, going to make choices about what companies we want, then we need to have those available. And if we say, okay, all insurance companies have to have this, then, like I said, you know, we're closing that door for people that say, hey, we don't want our insurance company to cover this. So that's my concern. And I just hope that our government makes the right choice about protecting the rights of individuals to make decisions in regards to what they want available. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Christensen? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, you had mentioned, and I'm sorry, I maybe had missed that, but that an insurance company had mandated contraception for you or someone you know. Is that something you care to elaborate on?
So there was like the national push to mandate that contraceptives be covered under insurance. And so they left at that time because there weren't a lot of companies just did it. And the one that they worked with at their job, if that makes sense.
Yes, I believe I understand what you're saying.
They decided to cover it. so that they wouldn't lose, you know, federal accreditation or whatnot. So does that make sense? Or?
Yes, thank you.
I'm nervous. Sorry.
You're doing well. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Next, we have Morgan Lynn from Juneau. Ms. Lim.
Thank you, Chair Prox and members of the Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim, and today I'm just testifying on behalf of myself. I'm calling in support of HB 17, a bill that would require that health insurance companies cover a 12-month disbursement of oral contraceptives at once. This coverage is extremely important for those who are off the road system, who have limited access to pharmacies, who work in jobs like on the slope or as smoke jumpers in the summertime, are fishermen. It's a common sense piece of legislation that is needed in this state. And I really support the bill. I hope you all take the time to investigate some of the claims that are made by people calling in. And I hope that you move this forward. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Lim? All right, thank you. And that concludes all those I have on my list. Are there any other folks out there that wanted to testify on HB 17? All right, with that, I encourage anyone that is listening or wants to, you can also provide written testimony to the committee if you just send that to hhss@akleg.gov. And with that, public testimony is now closed. All right. Do we have any questions for Representative Carrick or others that are online for questions? Do we have any amendments that anyone would like to offer? Representative Ruffridge.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Amendment 33-LS0222/A.1.
Object.
Okay, we have an objection. Mr. Ruffridge, would you like to, or I think first, I give the representative that raised the objection the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I object to Amendment 1, knowing that a lot of insurance companies in Alaska do cover Plan B. I believe it also might be covered under Medicaid, but there have been extensive studies that, you know, related to some of the public testimony that we've heard, that the main course of action for Plan B and for the drug is to delay to delay the release of an egg, and it doesn't impact implantation. So if an individual believes that implantation is conception, Plan B doesn't impact that. And so for those reasons, I oppose this amendment.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Chair Prox. So I think that Amendment number 1 certainly allows what I think is a bill that provides coverage for contraception, which is a valid component of medical care in our state. However, emergency contraception continues to have a controversial component to it. However, it is available over the counter. Individuals are able to go to many places across the state and access emergency contraception. The component of this bill is the mandate of coverage, which certainly would provide those who object to its use, not the potential to object, which I think is putting those persons who want the ability to object for moral purposes, the ability to not do so. And so I think that having emergency contraception as a portion of this bill would be ill-advised, and would like to amend to remove that and move forward with the bill otherwise. Thank you.
Any other comments? Representative Carrick?
Thank you to the chair. I am not in favor of Amendment 1. However, I defer to the will of the committee on the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mina, do you maintain your objection? Okay, and with that, we will need to take a vote. So, Madam Secretary, could you please call the roll?
Representative McCormick is not present. Representative Ruffridge?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Sumner?
Yes.
Representative Fields? Not present. Representative Mina?
No.
Chair Prax?
Yes.
4 yeas, 1 nay.
And with the, excuse me?
4 yeas and 1 nay.
Okay. And with a vote of 4 yeas and 1 nay, the amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments that anyone wants to offer? And with that, I would entertain a motion to move this HB 17 out of committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 17 work order 33-LS0222/A be moved from committee as amended with individual recommendations.
Point of order, Mr. Chair. I think it would be /8.1 now as amended.
As amended. Thank you. So I would correct that for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I will try that again.
You can try that again.
I move that HB 17 work order 33-LS0222/A.1 be moved from committee as amended with individual recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge. Do we have...
Point of order, I Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler.
I believe while the amendment was A1, once that has been amended into HB 17 /A, it still stands before us as /A as amended. It does not take on the color of point one.
My apologies.
That's all right.
Brief recess. On record, and we will allow the Legislative Affairs Agency to correct any technical difficulties with the numbering.
Mr. Chairman, one of my motions was correct.
Something was correct. Okay. Yes, we have the intent of the committee. And the intent is to move HB 17 as amended out of committee. And do we have objections? And seeing no objections, we will move HB 17 out of the Health and Social Services Committee. And with that completes our business for today. Are there any final questions or comments from the committee? And with that, we will adjourn, but please do stand by. We're going to have to do the sign-up sheet. And with that, the Health and Social Services Committee is adjourned at 5:21.